This episode of MiningStockEducation.com is brought to you by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of nearly 190 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at SandstormGold.com. That's SandstormGold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the NYSE American as S-A-N-D. Welcome back and thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Powers and this is the Mining Stock Education Podcast. Well, it's been a complete 2 years since I launched this podcast. And if you're a new listener or you've been listening for the past couple years, I'd like to say thank you. And I hope that this podcast has contributed in some way to your journey as a resource investor. If you'd like to reach me with questions, comments, and feedback, you can do so by emailing me at bill@miningstockeducation.com. Over the past 2 years, I've been able to feature some of the most knowledgeable and well-respected resource investing professionals, and I've learned a lot myself and thoroughly enjoyed the interviews, this whole process, and the relationships I've developed. I'd like to offer up in this episode some of the interview highlights from the past 2 years. What I've chosen in this compilation are 16 interview segments that offer up either inspiration or unique insights into mining stock investing from interviewees over the past 2 years. I've had so many great guests on the podcast so far that I couldn't feature everyone, but what I did feature should be well worth your time spent listening. Let's begin with hearing from top performing resource fund manager Warren Irwin on his experience with one of the mining sector's biggest scams, that being BREX. This is a 10-minute clip, but it's one of the most interesting mining investment stories you're going to hear.
What's interesting, I first touched on BREX when I was working at Deutsche Bank. I'd worked there for 3 years prior to starting Rosso. And what was exciting to me about it is I just heard about it, and I'd been just starting to tweak my interest in gold stocks. And it was also interesting for me is in 1991, when I graduated from MBA school, I'd spent some time in Indonesia, and I learned that it was a fascinating country. I had a professor who lived there who was really, really good to me, and he was able to show me around the country, gave me his car and driver, and I learned a ton about Indonesia. And what really occurred to me was there's a lot of money to be made there. And a very fascinating place. So when I combined my interest in gold with Indonesia, I was all over the story and very exciting at the time. I pretty much took all my savings at the time, which was about $250,000. I'd saved up initially about $80,000 to buy a house, but then I managed to triple that money in a real estate investment. Then I took the $250 and put it into BREX at around $18 level. So as it grew, I realized very quickly I had a lot of money at stake. At one point, I had a position of $5.6 million worth.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Well, yeah, especially over 20 years ago, it was a lot of money. And for a guy who was in his early 30s, it was quite a bit of money. So I really needed to follow the story closer than anybody else. And given I'd been to Indonesia and had some good contacts there, I thought it was really important for me to jump on a plane and get down there. So I followed as best I could here in Toronto, but I jumped on a plane, went down to Indonesia, established a lot of contacts with the media, with other investors in Jakarta, and I managed to talk my way onto one of the first site visits, which was really good. And I went to the site, looked around. I was pretty new to the business, so I saw a number of things which I had some questions about, but in general, things were good. One of the things that really freaked me out a little bit was I was having beers one night with the head of the local assay lab, and he was quite nervous. And I asked him, I said, John, there's gold there, isn't there? And he almost, frankly, he almost jumped right out of his skin. So it didn't exactly make me feel too great. But some of the other factors that were positive were that...
Can I ask you, at that point, what was your position size in BREX at the time you heard, got that response from him?
About $5.6 million, probably almost my peak position. And the other things I look for when I was on site, I look for, are the locals fooled? And obviously I had a level of skepticism going in anyways. But the locals were building homes around the site, so they were obviously sinking their life savings into it, so they were believers. There were a number of people working the rigs, a bunch of Australian rig workers. They seemed to be fooled. And, upon my return to Canada, I found actually a former BREX geologist who worked in the fly camps there, and he was completely fooled. And so there were a lot of people even intimately involved with BRIEX, really close to the source, that were completely fooled by what was going on there. And part of the reason for it was the gold was not visible gold. It was they were claiming it was just quite a bit of disseminated gold, so it wasn't visible in the core. And so upon that, my return, I thought the trip went reasonably well. Some of the questions I asked were pretty pointed. For instance, I remember asking Felderhoff when he was going to twin the holes, I guess giving an indication of the level of skepticism I had. And he said in the fall. So when I came back to Toronto and the fall came and went and there were no twinning of holes, it didn't make me feel super great. But the biggest turning point in my skepticism of the mining business is when I returned from my trip. By chance, I ran into this old, crusty old man in my elevator in my condo, and I was reading the front page of the Financial Post, and it was talking about BRIEX, and we just started chatting about BRIEX in the elevator ride down to the ground floor. And I'd mentioned I'd just been back from the site, and it turned out it was Dale Hendrick, who's former head of exploration for Kerr Addison Mines, a very seasoned and very skeptical mining guy who'd spent his career in the mining business. And he said, listen, I gotta get together. Let's sit down for lunch one day. So I agreed, and we sat down for lunch, and he told me his 20 reasons why BRIEX was a complete scam.
And had you sold any of your shares at that point?
No, not at all, no. And so he told me that reason, told me 20 reasons. But what was interesting for me is there were 20 logical counterpoints in all these points, like why didn't they keep half the core? Well, you need a large sample size, so they kept the skeleton core instead. Why did they do this? Well, there was always a reason why Dale's point was wrong. But what occurred to me was he really did have a lot of points, and but there were a lot of counterpoints. So it got me thinking a little bit more skeptical. So what I did is, with my contacts in Jakarta, I gave them the heads up. I said, listen, there's a guy here thinking this is a fraud. Can you guys just keep an eye out for me? And sure enough, fortunately for me, the one of the best things that ever happened to me is I was building my BRIEX house, and my builder phoned me up and said, Warren, I need some money. So I sold about half my position. I took myself off the small amount of margin I had. Actually, it might not have been small. I had $1 million borrowed on margin. So had I rode it to the end, I would have been in pretty bad shape financially. So I sold enough to pay my taxes, to get myself off margin, and to pay for the remainder of my house. And so that put me in good stead.
But you had not concluded it was a fraud yet.
No, not at all. No, that was total, that's totally luck. And it was really, really close to the top. It was something like $280 a share.
And so, you bought at 18, you said.
18, yeah. And I put $250,000 in at 18. Then I used some leverage on the way up. So it was quite high octane, right? And those were heady days on Bay Street. Lots of people were making lots of money. And and part of the reason BRIEX scam was able to happen in the first place was there was a lot of money created, $4 to $5 billion with Voisey's Bay discovery just before this. So there was lots of money, speculative money, sloshing around Bay Street. Yeah. So, anyways, I just kept asking all the questions, and I was reasonably skeptical, but I kept about half my position. And then my contact one day phones me up and said, Warren, in the middle of the night, phones me up, Warren, I think you're right. They've just killed the Guzman. And I go, oh boy. And I just...
Did you get that before the public knew?
Yeah, absolutely. I got that in the middle of the night. So I'm ready to hit the bid first as soon as the stock opens. Well, sure enough, the stock was halted. It halted all day. And they say, Mike the Guzman died. He fell out of the helicopter, which, of course, that was her story. And I phoned up the office in Jakarta or somewhere, one of their offices, and said, well, where did he fall out? Because I'd been on that exact helicopter. And they claimed he fell out between Samarinda and the site. And what concerned me about that is I knew the pre-flight inspection, and they were very, very stringent to make sure your seatbelt was on, that the doors were shut and the doors were locked. And that was a total impossibility that he accidentally fell out of a helicopter like was being portrayed by the company. So I knew there was something up. So at that point, I just sold all my shares into the market as soon as it happened, and I went short it. Now,
immediately short.
Yeah, immediately short. And then what's really funny is, a couple days later, I'm just going, man, oh man, I'm am I crazy? What am I thinking? This is this multi-billion-dollar company. And I'm thinking it's a fraud. What kind of, you know, you start getting the self-doubt again, right? And what do I know? And remember, I was 20 plus years ago, so my knowledge base wasn't what I have today. And we were at the stage where, you know, Freeport wanted it, Barrick wanted it, Placer Dome wanted it, Teck wanted it. All these major mining companies wanted to buy it, right? And they were all over everybody, all over the Indonesian government to become the most favored company to buy it. And here I am, little inexperienced analyst, calling it a fraud. And that, so, you know, it's one of those things. And what was interesting is we had I put on a large put position for the bank I worked for, Deutsche Bank, and it was pretty funny because I bought a whole bunch of put options, and then I got cold feet, and I said, you know, how could it be a fraud? So I just tried to unwind the position, but the traders were giving me lousy prices. So I said, no, screw you guys. I'll hold the position until they expire. And sure enough, we made a lot of money on those put options because, you know, we were able to. I think the stock was around 9 cents by the time we.
From you said 200 and.
Well, yeah. What happened is it went to. I think the all-time high was around $280 a share, and then there was a 10 for 1 split, and then eventually went down to zero. So it was quite a ride, that's for sure. And but what's interesting here is you may have noticed that I wrote that one article recently about Mike DeGuzman.
Yes.
In my opinion, absolutely 100%. Mike DeGuzman is alive and well, living in the Philippines
even today.
Absolutely, I've had friends not in the last 2 years, but I've had friends see him at restaurants in the Philippines, and I've had friends who have friends that have had meetings with him. And
to this day, would you say in the mining investment community, how many still accept the official narrative regarding Guzman, and how many see it the way you see it now?
Well, I would think probably 90% think De Guzman's dead. I don't think my views are widely known. I think if people knew what I knew, as in have enough friends who have seen him or know people who know him, they'd share that view. And there are enough people in the mining community that go in and out of the Philippines, and they know De Guzman's around, so it's not a big deal. But he faked his death, in my opinion.
Now on to two gentlemen who both sold their homes, then took the money, tripled it, so that they could leave their day jobs and focus on being full-time resource investors. First, here's David Earfley of JuniorMinerJunkie.com, followed by Brian Lenny of JuniorStockReview.com.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector, and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly. So you just have to do a lot of research. So between 2003 and 2005, the sector corrected that huge gain off the bottom. And then I saw that it was starting to come up around 2005. So I thought, you know what? This consolidation is probably over. The housing market has peaked. So if I'm going to sell my house and do this, this is the best time to do it. And not only that, but the house that I sold, it was a historic house in Pasadena that I was remodeling and restoring and doing all the work myself. So it made it a tougher decision.
You invested those proceeds, and then didn't you about triple your money in a couple years after?
Yes. And pretty much, I mean, it's the old Rick Ruleism, you know, one of my favorite. He's got so many of them. Was I confused a bull market with brains? You know, I just thought I was a genius. And, you know, 2008 came along and taught me a really, really good lesson.
And when did you begin investing full time as a mining stock investor, where this is your business, your profession, what you do to provide for yourself?
That was 2 years after I sold the house, about 2007. My wife at the time and I have a different wife now. My wife at the time and I, we put all our things in storage and moved to Buenos Aires after we sold the house.
So it goes back probably around 2005, 2006. It was actually the first time I had met my future brother-in-law. And he was talking about gold and a guy named Doug Casey. And I was extremely curious to understand, because you could tell that he was an intelligent guy, why he was sort of obsessed with these two topics. And so I followed along and did some more research and reading on my own, and kind of got into the monetary policy history, you know, the stuff that's gone on with the Fed, and then would eventually led into the quantitative easing. So I was hooked on the subject from that early standpoint of gold. And then from there, I learned trial and error. And in 2013, I took a major step or major risk in my life. And what we ended up doing, we sold our house, and I took 2/3 of the proceeds and put them into the stocks that I felt had the most opportunity or potential for profits. And so for those that have been following along with the junior sector for the last cycle, you'll know that 2013 to about the end of 2015 were just about the bottom of the cycle. And over those 2 years, I deployed that cash, and in 2016, reaped the rewards. And so what this enabled me to do was to leave my career as an engineer and pursue both investment and writing. And that's what I'm doing now.
Next is a clip from Steve Totteruk, a geologist turned stockbroker for Sprott U.S. Holdings, on why he focuses on investing in exploration companies after the first major discovery hole and what he looks for in that initial discovery hole.
Myself, with my experience in the sector, I prefer to go down a different route. I think we, again, touching on what the prospect generator is trying to do, make a discovery. I think we all recognize that the most exciting thing in the mining industry is if a little company makes a brand new discovery and they're able to successfully drill and grow it into a big valuable deposit and then be taken over by a major mining company. If you're an investor, if you can get in real early and then sit back and ride it all the way, if it culminates in that takeover at the end of the day, you should, make quite a bit of good money on that stock plate type of thing. And then again, you get to sell into the liquidity of the takeover. So that's my approach. I wait for the discovery drill hole. The best scenario would be if you had a crystal ball that worked and you could rub it and you could predict, time and time again, which junior is going to make the next discovery somewhere down the road, and you buy shares in there and you sit and wait. Well, you can't do that with any regularity. So I wait for the discovery announcement. And then if I like it, that's when I get in type of thing.
And what do you look for in particular in that initial hole and that discovery announcement?
Well, again, in order to get the happy ending at the end of the day with a big mining company coming in to take you over, they're basically looking for really big deposits or giant deposits. Giant deposits consist of drill holes that are big drill holes or giant drill holes, which equates to really wide intervals. Big deposits have lots of really big drill holes or lots of really wide drill hole intervals in them. The big deposits don't consist of small, narrow drill holes. That's what makes a small deposit type of thing. So ideally, I want to see a really wide interval of good grade mineralization, whether it's gold or copper and gold or silver or uranium, or zinc or nickel. You want to see a really big drill hole at good grades. Again, that if that was a mine today, could that mine make a profit? And even better, if metal prices go lower, could you still make a profit? So if I see that drill hole, that's when I like to get in type of thing.
And then those investors that, like you, that invest after that initial discovery drill hole is released, what should be the time frame or the perspective that investors have?
Well, if a company is going to be able to drill a big deposit, on average, it's going to take 2 to 3 years. It takes, if you're drilling, if you've got a really wide drill hole, I like to see ideally say 1,000 meters of 1% copper equivalent or 1.5 grams per ton or higher grade type of thing. And if you're drilling a hole that's 1,000 meters long, that's going to take you, 1 to 3 weeks for each drill hole. So if you've got to drill 100 drill holes, it's going to take you time. And on average, it's, 2 to 3 years type of thing. So you've got to be patient. When a company's actively drilling like that, you're probably going to get news releases coming out every 4 to 6 weeks. And, you just got to evaluate. If you keep getting good results, it's going in the right direction. You got to be patient. All drill holes aren't going to hit. You probably only need to you know, have 60 to 70% of the holes that you drill that are good, that means there's going to be maybe 30% that are, you know, not so good or terrible or bad in the middle of a good deposit. You can drill a blank zone. You move the drill over, you get back into the good mineralization. So you've got to be able to stay on top of that. And that's not easy for a lot of people to do, a lot of investors.
So if you get one bad drill hole, you don't necessarily just jump ship immediately. You wait to see what the fouling drill holes result in after the one poor drill hole?
That's the plan of attack. But again, you can, you know, just like some deposits have that blank and you can hit, you know, drill dusters in there, move back, move over, and you're back into it. But you can also start out from the discovery point where that first good drill hole is the one I want to see. The company keeps moving the drill over and the releases are good. And then 6 months, a year, year and a half down the road, even though it's going in the right direction, the company moves the drill over, there's nothing. It's a duster. They move it over again. It's another duster. That could mean that was the edge of the deposit and the story's over. You may have just drilled a small deposit. Even though you had big drill holes, it didn't grow into a big enough deposit. And there's some examples that's happened to me in a couple of companies. And in which case, you know, yeah, I should have sold a month earlier. Well, I didn't know, you know, that there was a fault or it just wasn't going to grow any bigger. You only know, you know, after the fact type of thing. And that just goes with it. That's fortunately, more times than not, it tends to work out okay. But along the way, you're definitely going to have, you know, call them disasters.
Next is Jayant Bhandari of Anarcho Capital on how he profits from arbitrage in the junior mining sector.
Well, arbitrage occurs everywhere in life. You want to buy the same can of milk, and if you go to two different stores, you will get very different prices. In fact, if you want to get diesel for your car or gasoline for your car, and if you go and visit two gas stations on two sides of the same street, they have very different prices, sometimes as much as 5 to 10% different from each other. Arbitrage exists in these extremely liquid commodities, and junior mining industry is an extremely illiquid industry, which means that arbitrage opportunities are even better and more, and offer you even more upside in this industry.
Where do you find arbitrage? Where does it occur most frequently within the junior resource sector?
Mostly when a liquid company tries to acquire an illiquid company, I see a very nice arbitrage opportunity. And the reason is that when you try to acquire an illiquid company, big investors do not pay much attention to the illiquid companies. Retail investors, people who can bid for a smaller amount of shares, have an opportunity in such situations. Also, when you have an acquiree company that has very tired shareholders who have stuck with that company for a very long time, who want to get out of that company as soon as possible, when a merger is announced, they get a liquidity event, which they exploit without actually sometimes doing simple math on what the equation of merger is, and they sell in this liquid event, leaving a lot of money on the table for people who might want to exploit this arbitrage opportunities. But also, Bill, one of the best and most exciting arbitrages I have seen are when the two companies are in completely different jurisdictions. So when a Canadian company wants to acquire an Australian company, or when an Australian company wants to acquire a company listed in London, that creates a very exciting arbitrage opportunity. And the reason, Bill, is that a lot of people who invest in Canada do not want to own shares in Australia or cannot trade in Australia because of the brokerage they use. And a lot of people are in these kind of situations. As a result, when a merger of this kind happens, people in one of the two markets tend to sell their stock as soon as possible. They dump their stock, and that creates sometimes extraordinary arbitrage opportunities for an astute investor.
Next is Nick the Mining Book Guy on why he likes to focus his mining stock investing on lesser followed, perhaps riskier, mining jurisdictions.
You like investing in lesser known jurisdictions or some jurisdictions that some people might consider a little more exotic or riskier. Can you share with the listeners why you like to focus on jurisdictions where maybe others don't have their eyes in that location?
Oh, Bill, I'm glad you honed in on that point because I think this is what I like to think separates what I do from even a lot of professionals or people that I hear about, because I guess there's two sides to it. I have a specific and a more general. On a specific point, going back a couple years, it's amazing to me looking back how I couldn't find anyone excited about West Africa as a specific region when I would go on to CEO.ca or even a lot of other sites or talk to people. And, you know, even to this day, it's not considered the most exciting place, but a lot of people have paid attention to the M&A that's gone on there, to a lot of the discoveries. And so I've already made a lot of money by honing in on West Africa early on and picking up on those jurisdictions that seem to have a positive momentum. And that leads to the more general point. I just don't feel there are many, if any, real experts in geopolitics. It sounds like geology, but if you're getting geopolitical advice from a geologist, that geologist probably doesn't know much more than I do. Now, it's true that some people really have been on the ground and they get a good feel for it, but anybody can follow that news online and can pick things up. And to be honest, I feel that I can get an edge that way and try to figure out where those emerging jurisdictions are. So I like using West Africa as an example that absolutely has worked for me as a region over the last couple years. But I'm picking up, you know, regions left and right. There's probably three or four around the world that I'm really honed in on. And that's often been a great way for me to hone in on the region and then start picking up those jurisdictions that I think are standing out within the region. And you can find some real diamonds in the rough, for a lack of better terms, for some of the juniors that are overlooked. And then if you're lucky, the momentum starts to turn, and you can really make a lot of money when there's a combination of a discovery and positive momentum in a jurisdiction.
Next is Sam Broom, investment broker with Sprott, offering his response to North American investors who have objections to investing in companies traded on the Australian Securities Exchange.
Now, I'd like to ask you a question from the perspective of a North American investor that potentially would be looking to invest on the Australian Securities Exchange. One of the biggest objections I've heard from North American mining stock investors is that if they were to invest in the Australian Securities Exchange, they're getting their news, you know, a day late, and the Securities Exchange is open when they're sleeping. What would be your response to someone with that perspective?
I would say that it's probably the only valid argument against the Australian exchange. I'm probably somewhat biased because it's the exchange I know the best from my past. But looking at the performance, and I would say the outperformance of the Australian sector, it's been pretty spectacular. I'm actually halfway through writing a Sprott's thoughts about this very topic. So for those listening, keep a lookout for that. That is one issue. I would say, depending on what you're investing in, if you are investing in things where they're likely to be news flow, you know, that you're going to need to know that very second, it can be a problem. But I would argue that, you know, the best investment opportunities, you know, you're not going to see one-off news events that really dramatically change the story that much. The one exception is probably these junior exploration stocks where drill results come out and you want to be able to get in or out then and there. My response to that would be, if you've got a discount internet broker that allows you to trade 24/7, the Aussie market's not really when you're asleep. If you actually look at the time zone, I mean, perhaps if you're on the east coast, it might, you know, the US, that might be the case. But for example, right now, the Aussie market opens at 3 p.m. Pacific time and closes at 9 p.m. Pacific time. So I'm watching my clients and my own positions you know, when I get home in the evenings on my app on my phone. So, you know, East Coast, that's going to be, what, six to midnight. So it's not middle of the night type stuff. So as long as your broker's got access to trading 24 hours a day, I don't think that's a valid argument. If you can't trade the market whenever you want, you've just got to be a little selective in what I was saying before, your risk management. Make sure you don't have too much in one name, especially the junior stuff. You know, in the bigger names, you can use things like stop losses and things like that to help you out on that one.
There's much more to come in this episode right after this message from one of our sponsors. For millennia, ancient pharaohs prospered from unparalleled riches made possible by Egypt's resource-rich gold deposits. But despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world, but that's all about to change. Aton Resources is leading the charge on the Egyptian mining revival. As the only public exploration company in Egypt, Aton Resources has first-mover advantage, focused on their 100% owned Abu Marawat concession. Aton Resources is advancing several exploration targets, including the recent discovery of the legendary Lost Mountain of Gold at Rod Ruin. Learn more about this exciting drill program and other news at atonresources.com. Aton trades on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF. Next is Keith Neumeyer, the CEO of First Majestic Silver, on the difference between whether the banks are manipulating the silver price or simply protecting their books.
You know, I'm not of the, you know, belief that, you know, the regulators are anywhere, you know, corrupt in any way or in collusion with the banks. I'm not there, and I know there are people that conclude that, but you know, being part of the system, I don't believe that. You know, the banks are highly regulated, and they don't like to be sued. You know, they have shareholders as well, just like, you know, our company does. And, you know, they try to do everything above the books. So at least as far as I'm concerned, they do. But, you know, now and then, you know, traders do get offside and do make bad decisions, and they try to protect their book. They get offside in a position. You know, let's say you own, you know, a million ounces of silver, and all of a sudden this, you know, the silver's going against you, you're going to try to hold the price in there as best as you can, you know, to protect your book. And unfortunately, it happens mostly on the short side because most of the banks are short the metal. And the reason why that is because it's an industrial metal. So, you know, if you're JP Morgan or HSBC or Scotia, you know, you have miners that you're buying the metal from, but you have actual manufacturers who rely on the metal to produce televisions, for its automobiles, computers, you know, cell phones, solar panels, you know, batteries, you know, electric cars, and, you know, all the things that we use silver for. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, one of these big banks sells Sony 50 million ounces of silver at $17 an ounce, and then silver's $20. You know, it's all of a sudden that trade is going to cost that bank more money. So, you know, it's, you know, the whole word manipulation, I know a lot of people use it, you know, I, and quite frankly, I've used it myself many times, because when I see banks acting collectively to price anything, and they have an idea in mind where they want to price it, that's manipulation. But if someone's acting solely on their own and just protecting a position, like in the case of the example I gave you, that's, you know, more like protecting your book. And it's hard to really differentiate between what's actually going on in the marketplace. Are these people actually trying to protect their book, or are they actually manipulating the markets?
Next is Brian London, editor of the Gold Newsletter, on whether economic or geopolitical factors are the primary driver of the gold price.
Well, normally, almost always, it is economic. Geopolitical issues tend to affect gold only in short bursts, and there's not any real reason that I've ever recommended that anyone should buy gold. First off, there's no logical reason to buy gold if there is some kind of a geopolitical issue. Gold is a monetary instrument. It is money. It is a way to protect against government degradation of the currency, and that should be the real reason and only long-term reason to buy gold. But these short-term geopolitical flashpoints, they tend to come and go so quickly and resolve themselves so quickly that investors buying on those kinds of issues typically end up holding the bag.
Next is Chris Berry, president of House Mountain Partners, on how retail mining investors can track the price of niche metals.
I mentioned to you pre-interview that Largo Resources is one of the companies on my watch list. And from July to September, in about an 8 to 9 week period, it quadrupled in price, which then caused me to try to seek out what was going on in the vanadium price. And it was a little frustrating, as I've previously shared, trying to locate the price. What would be your thoughts, or could you share with listeners some advice regarding trying to research these niche metals and try to discover the price and the price trends, because it's not widely reported?
Yeah, that is a real challenge when you, I guess, look at vanadium or lithium or cobalt or any of these, you know, niche metals, as you had mentioned before. There really is no specific price. A lot of these metals are priced based off of what I call relationships between buyers and sellers over handshake agreements. The price can vary based on the grade or the purity of the material, and also the amount of material, typically per ton, that is bought and sold. And so, you know, just in terms of getting your handle, on the vanadium price, outside of subscribing to, you know, a pricing service, your best bet is to try and stay as close as you possibly can to the existing producers of vanadium in terms of press releases or financial disclosure documents. Or also, you know, some of the juniors out there do, you know, a pretty good job, I think, of trying to keep investors clear or focused on what the current price trends are. You know, with just to sort of finish up maybe a little bit on vanadium, it's a little bit challenging, again, because it's really an oligopoly. You have a metal that is both geographically concentrated. I think about 80% of the overall production comes from South Africa, China, and Russia. And, you know, amongst those countries, it's also concentrated based on the number of companies that actually produce vanadium, typically as a byproduct from steel slag. So, you know, looking at those companies in particular, I think is a good place to start in terms of getting an idea or a feel for specific pricing trends.
Next is Dave Kranzler, mining stock fund manager and editor of the Mining Stock Journal, as he comments on shorting mining stocks and how he hedges his mining stock portfolio.
So my next question relates to shorting mining stocks. What's your general perspective on shorting mining stocks, and how and when do you do that? And if you could share any examples, please.
In general, I'm kind of opposed to shorting mining stocks because it's, you know, these juniors are kind of like the internet stocks were in the, you know, the late 1990s, you know, as opposed to a lot of those internet stocks were no revenues, no prospects, and they were still getting $1 to $2 billion market caps. A lot of these juniors are working on developing properties, and even if they end up with a property that only has 500,000 ounces on it, if the price of gold is you know, between $1,500 and $2,000 an ounce, that means that junior mining company is going to be worth a lot of money. Now, right now, relative to that potential, these companies are trading at pennies on the dollar. So I don't think that's the type of story that you want to short, because it's a thinly traded market. The companies don't have a lot of share float outstanding. And, you know, if you're short one of these stocks and all of a sudden the market takes off, you're going to feel like you got run over by a herd of elephants. So in general, I don't recommend shorting, especially individual names. Now, there has been, over the last couple years, I have put some, you know, avoid this name type ideas in the Mining Stock Journal, and I did it with MX Gold, and I'd have to look up the chart price, but it might have been like at 30 cents, and now I think it's under 10 cents. And as we were talking earlier, Bill, I did it with, you know, I put Northern Dynasty in there. I said, just avoid it, because this property is, in my opinion, it's never going to get developed. And Northern Dynasty was at, now I didn't recommend shorting it. I just said, avoid it. I said, if you're aggressive, you might want to short it. And that was at $1.38 when I recommended that. and now the stock's, I think it's closed at 47 cents on Friday. And then that Novo Resources, when that thing traded up over $6, I actually tried to borrow it for our fund and short it. And I couldn't get our custodian that we use for our fund wouldn't let us short a five-letter stock. So we weren't able to short it, but I did put in my mining stock journal, I advised my readers to avoid it. And then, you know, the stock went from six to under three, and I think it's probably back over four now. And again, it you know, that's one of those stocks that I would recommend avoiding at this point until there's a lot more news out on it that shows that they have something that not only do they have a viable resource there, but it's something that can be viably converted into gold that they can sell. So I guess it's probably a long-winded way of saying in general, if I don't like a junior mining stock, I don't, you know, I wouldn't tell someone to short it. I would just tell them to avoid it. So that's my view on whether or not you should short mining stocks. In terms of what I would potentially recommend is there's things that you can do to hedge a long portfolio in mining stocks. And in our fund, when we think that there's going to be a period of time where gold's going to be manipulated lower and, you know, it's a volatile sector, so the mining stocks are going to have, you know, say a 10 to 20% pullback, what we do is we'll hedge out at least 50% of our long position of our mining stocks and sometimes up to 100% if we want to, you know, get a little speculative in terms of our view on a pullback or a, you know, a short-term downtrend in the sector. And the way that we do that is we use JDST, which is the inverse of JNUG. And the reason why we use that is because it's triple leveraged and we can put on a hedge using JDST that it only costs us a third of the total size of our stock portfolio, right? Because there's three times leverage there. So a third of the value of JDST versus the total market cap of our share portfolio is theoretically should move the same, right? In percentage wise. And we take it even further than that because you can do it with putting up even less capital, and that's to use deep in the money calls that are near expiration. So as an example, JDST closed on Friday at 49.86. And if you take a look at the JDST 42 calls that expire next Friday, on Friday they went out, indicated 740 bid, 840 offered. So if you can buy those for $8 per option, you're essentially going long JDST with about 14 cents of premium because you got the cost of the option plus the strike price is 50. JDST closed at 49.86. So there's 14 cents of premium in there. And that's just the cost of putting on a less capital intensive hedge than actually going out and buying the number of shares in JDST that we would need to use the hedge position. And then there's also transactions costs involved there because if we continue to believe the market is going to go lower, and I'm not saying I think the market's going lower next week, but we'll roll the call options forward to the next week. And we try to pick out a deep in the money call option that will minimize the amount of time premium that we pay because it obviously reduces the cost of the hedge. So the other problem with these triple levered trusts is that because they're essentially pure derivatives, they have a huge time premium decay. I've seen articles where they, you know, these triple levered trusts, and it doesn't matter what it is, they lose about 10% a month because of the premium decay. So that's why we look at it in terms of a short-term trade. We use short-term calls, and our preference is to not go long the actual trust because you're kind of, with that decay factor in there, you're kind of swimming upstream, and you need a big move in a short period of time to actually do well going long either of these trusts, whether it's JDST if you've got a bearish view or JNUG if you've got a bullish view.
Next, we're going to hear from Rick Rule of Sprott U.S. Holdings on how he vets younger, unproven mining CEOs. What are some things that you're going to look at in a younger, unproven CEO that would cause you to maybe consider investing in his or her company?
If I don't know him or her, I better know a couple people who do. It's a fairly small business. And if somebody hasn't proven themselves with their own friends, they're not going to prove themselves with my clients. I remember going back many, many, many years, we wrote one of the startup checks for a great junior success called Altius Minerals. The CEO at that time was a 23-year-old, painfully skinny prospector from Newfoundland, Brian Dalton, wasn't known in financial markets. But it turned out that he was extremely well known in exploration markets in Newfoundland, the two geologists that generated the Voisey's Bay nickel deposit, Chislett and Verbisky. They became legendary. Both knew and vouched for this young man extraordinarily. So if I don't know the person, I better know somebody who does know them, or else the chances of them getting some money from Sprott are nil.
When you're querying a newer CEO that you're being introduced to, do you sometimes ask them regarding their knowledge of mining history or past successful mining promoters or CEOs?
Well, I normally ask other people about them. In other words, allowing them to tell me good things about themselves is something that you have to endure. That's something that promoters do. But I'm much more interested in hearing them tell me the names of people that I already know who I can query them about that. The next thing that you do, having had them pass the sniff test, in other words, having had people who know them, who I know, vouch for them, is I try and figure out what it is on their resume, however short their resume might be, that qualifies them specifically for the task at hand, understanding that the process of exploration is very much a research and development process. It's about answering a series of unanswered questions. And what I want to know then about the CEO is his or her resume sufficient that I care about the thesis that they might have developed? And do I believe that they have enough experience answering the same kinds of questions that the method by which they propose to test the thesis is both efficacious, in other words, will it answer the question, and efficient, which means will it answer the question reasonably from an economic point of view. When somebody says to me that they have been a success in mining, but the part of mining that they have been a success in isn't directly related to the task at hand, I don't equate that prior success with any indication that they may or may not be successful in the future.
Next is the president of PDAC, Glenn Mullen, on how to prepare to attend a mining investment conference in order to maximize what you get out of it.
With all that PDAC the convention has to offer, if you were a first-time retail mining stock investor, how would you personally proportion your time over those 4 days?
That's a great question, and I'll tell you, just using my own strategy, I still do the same thing at this convention that I've done all the way back as far as I can remember. I begin with the program. I actually look at the program and I start ticking off areas of interest. So is it gold and gold seminars? Is it lithium? Is it rare earth elements? Every investor has their sweet spot or their areas of interest. It might be financing. It might be social license issues. There's a pretty broad spectrum of programming talks and seminars at the PDAC convention. So I would invite everyone to begin with a very good look at the program, highlight areas of your own personal interest, and then develop your own schedule and work that into the 4 days of the programming. So it begins on the Sunday, ends on the Wednesday. And one of the things that's extraordinary is it's just as packed at the end on the Wednesday as it is at the beginning. So, you know, definitely very difficult to not fill days, but time will be best used by those who actually take the effort to build their own schedule.
Next comes Dave Mathewson, a serially successful gold exploration geologist, on how much of a junior gold company's budget should be spent on actual exploration.
when the investor is looking at how a company spends the money that it raises, what percentage of money raised do you think needs to be spent on actual exploration and not just G&A?
That's a very good question, and I have what I think is a pretty good answer to it. When I worked for Newmont, we, and that would be Bruce Harvey, myself, and a few others, we tried to achieve a 70% money into the ground. Now, that left 30% for G&A and all these other superfluous things. That was our goal, and we came very close. And it was extraordinary because the past was maybe 50%. And then when this team left, it became, once again, a dismal, probably less than 50%. I look at juniors, on the other hand, and I would say 80% of the money should go directly into the ground, and that is directly toward the discovery process, whatever methods are being employed, geochemistry, geophysics, drilling in particular, but 80%, no less than that, should be implemented or achieved or conducted for an exploration for junior companies.
Moving on to Bannerman Resources CEO Brandon Monroe discussing what is corporate social responsibility and why the mining investor should care about it when assessing a mining investment. So Brandon, what is corporate responsibility, also often referred to as CSR?
There's a broader definition of CSR that seems to float around a little bit, which incorporates all of the good things that a company should be doing and implies that they shouldn't be doing some of the previous behavior that we saw several decades ago in the mining industry. But Bill, I don't think that that definition is particularly useful. I prefer to think about corporate social responsibility or corporate social investment as the things that a company does and invests in over and above its social license to operate. So if you think about a company that's in the mining sector, obviously it needs to comply with regulatory matters, whether it's permitting, labor laws, environmental laws, and so on. It's well understood in mining that you need a social license to operate over and above that. You need a community, a host community that is prepared to at least tolerate or better still support the mine. CSR sits above that level of thinking and strategy as a risk mitigant.
Why should mining investors care about corporate social responsibility?
Well, it has the potential to enhance the value of a project or decimate the value of a project if you don't have local support. Local being host communities, management of NGOs and other interest groups, and of course, host governments as well. So for the mining sector, it's a particular area of focus, really for two reasons. The first one is mining by its nature, it's extractive, it's non-renewable. So there is always some degree of negative consequence with mining. That's just inescapable. Now, I would argue that a well-run mine has a lower environmental footprint than chopping down some bushland or some forest and building a shopping center, and certainly has a lower footprint than many agricultural activities. But nonetheless, many people in the broader community associate mining with destruction of a small area and other negative things. So there has to be a balancing of that and social license to operate and corporate social responsibility above that is a mechanism for doing that. The other reason why it's an important thing to focus on is community engagement and CSR and so on is something that comes first nature to industrial and manufacturing companies that have customers because they're constantly advertising to those customers, they're constantly building a brand. They're constantly trying to influence those customers with all the great things that they do and all of the sponsorships and that type of thing. Whereas for mining companies, many management teams in smaller mining companies, they don't have to face those customers because they're just selling into an industrial buyer. And as we know, the challenges in a small mining company are immense at times. And something as nuanced and subtle and right brain as CSR does sometimes fall by the wayside.
Could CSR be considered charity?
Good question, Bill. A lot of people They put it in the same bucket. They see CSR as charity, the visible part of CSR. They see mining companies, for example, supporting a local orphanage or a school or something like that. I'm very clear in my mind on this, that from an investor's point of view, you need to distinguish very clearly between CSR and charity. I see CSR as an investment in a mining project that pays a return either through community support, risk mitigation, or other positive strategic outcomes, such as positioning a company as a developer of choice within a community and enabling a premium on consolidation or M&A later. The moment that you can't link CSR investment to one of those positive outcomes, it just becomes giving money, and that's charity. And I believe fervently that it's not the role of a mining company to simply give money. That's the role of investors. If they want to take their profits out of a mining company, pay their tax, and then hand it over as charity in some form, that's totally up to them. And that's an investor's prerogative, an investor's decision. But when you're running a mining company, you should only be spending investors' funds if they either mitigate risk or produce some other tangible positive benefit. So I would argue they're totally different, but unfortunately, out there in the world, a lot of people see them as the same thing.
Finally, we're going to hear from Jamie Keach, co-founder and chief investment officer of Resource Insider, as he shares whether a diligent, non-accredited retail mining investor can achieve mining investment success without being a well-connected insider.
I've observed online that there's a very passionate retail investment crowd that follows the junior mining space. So my next question is, do you think it's possible for a diligent, non-accredited retail investor to succeed in junior mining speculation without being a well-connected Vancouver insider?
What I would say to that is, yes, it is absolutely possible, but it's very difficult. Now, if we're in the midst of a bull market and everything's going up, then it's very easy. And I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to this out there that have been in that person and been in that experience. Some of them will know that they're getting lucky, and others will think that they're a genius. And the ones that know they were getting lucky probably still have some of the money they made on that. It's very difficult to properly evaluate projects. One, if you don't have the time to commit to it, and two, if you don't know what you're looking at. And the average retail investor doesn't have that. That being said, I have met retail investors. I have met, I'm thinking of one person in particular, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. So you really... It is possible, but it requires commitment. And the reason, I think what a lot of people don't understand is how complex it is. Now, I say that even for myself. So I'm a mining engineer. I've worked largely in open pit projects, in coal, in iron ore, in gold. I'm not an expert on everything. So when I evaluate a deal, chances are I've never worked on a project like that. But chances are I know somebody who has. So I'll tap, be they geologists or other engineers or technical experts that are familiar with that type of deposit, that are familiar with that country and that environment, and they know what to look for to see a success. They know what can go wrong in that environment. And it really is a group effort generally. So that's a lot of the advantages that someone in my position has. Now, you can make up for those advantages, but you've got your work cut out for you.
And the successful retail investors that I've met, they usually come to conferences like this. We're at the SPROC conference. Yep. They connect with geos. They get their email. They get their phone numbers. And then when they're looking at investing a significant amount of money, they usually call up those geologists and ask for the technical opinion.
And you should do that. And to add to that point is, don't just take the word of the company you're investing in. If you ask them, then they always have a great project. The key is to develop that sort of network you're talking about, where you meet geos or other technical or financial experts familiar with these type of deals that you can draw on their opinion of deals that are not their own. You know, you don't want to ask a barber if you need a haircut, because the answer is always yes.
That's right. And another thing with these conferences, I can think about what Rick Rule says. Some of the best places you can find to invest are asking the CEOs of mining companies that are here. Ask them for referrals of what would be they would consider a good company.
Yeah, and I mean, that goes back to our point earlier that, you know, these people are the industry insiders. You know, I mentioned in my ebook we recently released called The Resource Insider that a lot of these people running these companies are extremely talented people. You know, they could be probably CFOs or senior management positions at big companies, or they could be investment bankers pulling in $500,000 a year, no problem. And they give up those bigger title jobs to run, you know, little tiny junior companies with huge upside but very high risk. The way they balance that is they get to spread their capital. They get to invest in these other deals. And, you know, they get access to things that most people would not. And that really helps balance the risk of running one junior company, which at the end of the day has a low chance of working out.
Again, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Mining Stock Education Podcast, and I look forward to bringing you more quality interviews in 2019. All the best.
Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education Podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.